Good morning, everyone.
Then we'll begin.
We're resuming after a very long break. We're really grateful to Mother and Sri Aurobindo that it's possible to start these sessions again. We left off, we stopped last March without having finished Canto 4 of Book 7. We were reading that section. So I think that's where we'll start now. Yeah, we're doing this experiment. This is the first time we're doing this. We're trying to video film the Sunday morning sessions. Before we were just doing audio recording, but now we'll try and see how it works with the camera.
We are broadcasting live also on YouTube.
Oh, we're also broadcasting live on YouTube. So.
Like we're doing for the initial.
Yes, yes. Okay. So if you have a look on page 514, this is Book 7, Canto 4. This is the triple soul forces. Savitri is looking for her soul, and on the way towards that discovery, she encounters three Madonnas, three soul powers. And we read already about the Madonna of compassion, divine compassion and pity, and we read about the Madonna of might, of power. And now this section here on page 514 at the break, we begin to read about the third Madonna, the Madonna of light and wisdom. Mm-hmm. Will you read, Sudhanya?
Yes. Ascending still her sleeps of her womb, she came into a high and happy space, a wide tower of vision, whence all could be seen, and all was centered in a single view, as when by distance separate saints grow one, and a harmony is made of grief at one. The wind was still, and fragrance packed the air. There was a carol of birds and murmurs of bees, and all that is common and natural and sweet, yet intimately divine to heart and soul. A nearness filled of the spring to its source, and deepest things sensed of the earth's groans and grooves.
Thank you. So this passage also follows the same pattern as the rest of the canto. First, with a description of the setting, the landscape in which the Madonna appears. And Savitri has been moving higher and higher from the low and prone and listless ground, rocky, and where the first Madonna was seated on a stone. We moved higher up, as if up a mountain, and there she encountered the Madonna of Might in a beautiful, fragrant atmosphere, as if halfway up a mountain. And now, as Savitri ascends further on her spirit's upward route, she comes into this high and happy space, which is like a tower, as if she's climbed to the top of a tower, and she can see all around. Everything was centered in a single view. With one look, she can see the whole panorama. There at that height, the wind was still and fragrance packed the air. There were birds singing, a carol of birds, a murmur of bees, and all that is common and natural and sweet, yet intimately divine to heart and soul. There, Savitri feels a nearness thrilled of the spirit to its source, a sense that spirit is finding what Savitri is searching for, the source of her being. No? Their deepest things seemed obvious, close, and true. Is it clear? Anybody would like to ask anything? So in this high space, another woman, a Madonna, is sitting. She's as if surrounded by clear and crystal light. She seems to be the seventh center of that vision of peace. Will you read, Helmut?
Here, living center of that vision of peace, a woman sat in clear and crystal light. Heaven had unveiled its luster in her. Her feet were moonbeams. Her face was bright sun, was a bright sun. Her smile could persuade a dead Lazarus live again and feel the hands of calm. A low music world came her floating voice. Savitri, I am thy sacred soul. I have come down to the wounded, desolate earth, heal her pangs, and lull her heart to rest, and lay her head upon the mother's lap, that she may dream of God and know his peace, and draw the harmony of higher spirit into the living of earth. I showed her the figures of Christ, God, and bring strength and solace to her struggling life. High things that now are only birds and bones, I reveal to her in the body of my power. I am peace that steals into man's warm breast, amid the rain of hell his acts create a hostel where heaven's messages can move. I am charity with the kindly hands that bliss. I am silence with the noisy tramp of life. I am knowledge falling on the cosmic man.
Thank you. So this Madonna too has come to bring healing to our wounded, desolate earth. Now we feel very much in need of this healing. Like a mother, she wants to lull us, lull our hearts to rest, laying our heads upon the mother's lap, so that the earth may dream of God and know his peace, and draw the harmony of higher spheres, the harmony that belongs to higher realms of consciousness, draw it down into the rhythm of Earth's rude, troubled days. This Madonna has come to show to the Earth the figures of bright gods, and to bring strength and solace to her struggling life. And she says that high things, high truths that we now only experience as words and form, this Madonna has the power to reveal to them, to the earth, in the body of their power, what they can do. She brings peace that steals, it just creeps in almost unnoticed into our human war-worn breast, in the midst of the hell that our human acts create. And she offers a shelter, a hostel where heaven's messengers can lodge. She is charity, generously giving with kindly hands wherever there's a need. And she brings silence in the midst of the noisy tramp of life. And she brings knowledge, looking in detail on the map of cosmos, of the world, and everything in it. Juan, you want to read?
Just a moment. I understand that words and forms are turned into...
Not only into action, but they're embodied, yes, so that they can be active.
How can forms be...
They embody certain powers. They have effects.
One
lacerated, wounded. You know, if you have to go through thorns and it tears at your skin, lacerated. So the heart of earth is wounded, so many wounds. The first Madonna gave pity and help and soothing, but she couldn't cure those wounds. But this Madonna has the power to bring healing. So she continues, Joanna.
In the anomalies of the human heart, where good and evil are close bedfellow, and light is by darkness dark at every step, where his largest knowledge is in it, I am the power that led towards the best, and works for God and looks up towards the high. I make even sin and error stepping stone, and all experience a long march towards life. Out of the inconscient, I build consciousness and lead to that to reach immortal life.
Thank you. In the anomalies, the contradictions of the human heart, where good and evil are close bedfellows, they sleep together, they are always together, can't be separated. Even light is dogged by darkness at every step, like a faithful dog following at his master's heel. The largest human knowledge is a form of ignorance. But this Madonna is always taking these circumstances and contradictions of human life and laboring towards the best possible result and outcome. Her power works for God and looks up to the heights, to the highest possibilities. And she's even able to make sin, wrongdoing, and error, mistakes, into stepping stones, which carry a future possibilities towards the future. I make all experience a long march towards light, she says, so that it's not that there's any irrevocable mistake. Everything can be a stepping stone to a higher light. Out of the inconscient, I build consciousness and lead through death to reach immortal life. And now she's going to share some of her knowledge with Savitri and with us. Will you read?
Many are God's forms by which he grows in man. They stamp his thoughts and deeds with divinity, uplift his stature of human clay, or slowly transmute it into heaven's gold. He is the good for which men fight and die. He is the war of right with Titan wrong. He is free from the fire. He is valor, guarding still the desperate pass, or long and erect on the shattered barricade, or sentinel in the dangerous arena. He is the crown of the martyr burned in flame, and the glad resignation of the saint, and courage indifferent to the wounds of time, and the hero's might wrestling with death and fate. He is wisdom incarnate on the glorious throne, and the calm autocracy of the sage's room. He is the high and solitary thought, aloof above the ignorant multitude. He is the prophet's voice, the sight. He is beauty, nectar of the passionate soul. He is the truth by which the spirit lives. He is the riches of the spiritual vast, poured out in healing streams on indigent life. He is eternity, lured from hour to hour. He is infinity in a little space. He is immortality in the arms of death.
Thank you. These are some of the many forms which God, the divine, takes in humanity, and so that humanity can grow. These forms help human beings to become more than human, or the best they can be. These forms, when they appear, put a mark on the human being's thoughts and acts, a mark of something higher, something holy and true. And in this way, the stature of the human clay, our material human body, gets lifted up. It even can be slowly transmuted, transformed into heaven's gold by this contact with the forms of divinity. God appears as the good for which men fight and die, that they believe in and are ready to sacrifice their lives for. He is the war of right with Titan wrong, the perverted power of the Asura. He is freedom, rising deathless from her pyre. Pyre is the funeral fire where the body is consumed. So it may seem as if freedom has been destroyed in one place or another, or time and another. But freedom always, like the famous bird, the phoenix, she rises from that funeral pyre and lives again. This is one of the forms which the divine takes. Here it is God. These are God's forms, forms of the Lord, of the divine. His valor, courage, bravery, guarding still the desperate pass. There are famous occasions in history when one man or a very few men have managed to block and prevent whole armies, you know, when the cause was a good one. Or that valor can also show itself as a single person, single brave individual, all alone, standing straight up on the shattered barricade when people were fighting in the streets to achieve freedom and liberty and their rights. They would block the streets, and those barricades would have to be manned. Maybe sometimes whole areas were saved by the valor of a single person. Or a sentinel, also standing alone on watch, ready to give a warning when necessary. A sentinel in the dangerous, echoing night, when it's so hard to be standing alone and hearing all kinds of noises and not knowing what dangers are coming near, and having to show great courage and steadfastness on occasions like that. These are expressions of the Lord's presence in humanity. The Lord also is the crown, the reward that is given to the person who sacrifices himself completely. The martyr burned in flame. Famous example, of course, is Jeanne d'Arc. There are many other such examples. But he also shows himself as the glad resignation of the saint, the one who accepts patiently all kinds of difficult situation and courage, indifferent to the wounds of time, ready to take whatever sufferings are necessary. The hero's might wrestling with death and fate. Of course, King Aswapati himself is such a hero, as we have read earlier in the poem. The Lord also shows himself as wisdom incarnate, as a living being, acting as a great ruler and guide. Calm autocracy of the sages rule. In Indian mythology, we think of Janaka as one such sage who lived apparently as an ordinary ruler, but was carrying the divine within his heart, wisdom incarnate on a glorious throne. And that calm autocracy, the rule of one individual, in this case a sage. The divine expresses himself as the high and solitary thought, aloof above the ignorant multitude. Those special beings who are able to rise to a much higher level of thought beyond the ordinary human level. Then he may express himself as the voice of the prophet and the sight of the seer, of the rishi. But he also expresses himself as beauty, which is the nectar, the drink of immortality of the passionate soul. Elsewhere in the poem, Shobindo tells us, beauty is his footprint, showing us where he has trod. And he tells us we can follow that footprint of beauty. It will lead us to the divine. He's the truth by which the spirit lives. And he's also the riches, all the wealth of the spiritual vast, the infinite possibilities of the spirit, which are poured out in healing streams on indigent life, on our little human life, which is so poor and helpless in comparison. The Lord, the One, he is eternity being led on from hour to hour. He's infinity in a little space. Another thing that Sri Aurobindo tells us several times, that infinity can be experienced in a moment, in a short vision, in a word. Something limitless can be experienced or expressed. The Lord is immortality in the arms of death. When it seems that all is finished there, the possibility of immortal existence is there because of his presence. Is it Devan sitting up there? Will you read?
These powers I am, and my call they come. Thus slowly I lift man's soul nearer the light. A human mind clings to its ignorance and to its littleness, the human heart, and to its right to grieve the earthly life. Only when eternity takes time by the hand, only when infinity weds in finite spot, can man be free from himself and live with God. I bring meanwhile the gods upon the earth. I bring back hope to the despairing heart. I give peace to the humble and the great, and shed my grace on the foolish and the wise. I shall save earth if earth consents to be saved. Then love shall at last, unwounded, tread earth's soil. Man's mind shall admit the sovereignty of truth, and body bear the immense descent of God.
Thank you. So this is the Madonna speaking, telling about what she can do. These powers I am, and at my call they come, she says. And in this way, I'm slowly uplifting man's soul nearer the light. But like the other Madonnas, she too experiences rejection and neglect. Human mind clings to its ignorance. And the human heart clings to its littleness. And the earthly life clings to grief, indulges itself in grief. So this can only change, she says, when eternity takes time by the hand, when infinity weds the finite's thought, when these divine powers, divine states of eternity and infinite get united with our human state. Only then can we human beings become free from our littleness and live with the Lord. But she says, in the meantime, I, the goddess of light, the Madonna of light, I bring the gods here upon earth, and I bring hope to the despairing hearts, and I bring peace to the humble and the great, and I shed my grace on the foolish just as much as on the wise. My mission is to save earth, she says, but earth has to consent, has to agree to be saved. Our material existence has to accept transformation. If earth consents to be saved, then it's possible for love to at last be able to move freely or on the earth without being wounded and defaced. Then the human mind will accept the rule of truth, that the truth is the supreme power. Then, when that happens, body shall bear the immense descent of God, promised transformation of the human body and the human substance can come about. This is her offering, her promise. But just as the other Madonnas were faced with, and Savitri was faced with, the echo, the contradictory echo of hostile beings, so too this glorious goddess of light and wisdom has to hear the echo of an opposing power.
Crying, the word echo, naked and shivering came. A voice of the sense-shackled human mind carried its proud, complaining power, hatched by the limits of a mortal force. Bound in the chains, imprisoned in his body and his brain. Mortal cannot see God's might before, sharing in his vast and deep, which stands unguessed within our ignorant heart, and knows all things, and may only see the cosmic surface. Then, wondering what may lie behind of me, I, from the sense, a little way he delves to the depths below, soon he stops, he cannot reach life's core. Or come home to the throbbing heart, he sees the naked body of the truth, too often baffled by her endless garbs, cannot look upon her soul within. Then, furious for knowledge, abseas all details, out of steps and deeds, only the shapes content involves for you. Spirit escapes or dies beneath his knife. He sees a blind stretch, a giant waste, crowding the riches of infinite, he has made his central view. Then the sex masters its processes to what which moves all his skin from his gaze. Pouring eyes miss his human height, unless the blind man's subtle, uncaring touch or the slow, traveler's sight. So, revealing contact, yet is he visited into his life. An inspiration comes from the unknown, but only reason and sense he feels are sure. They only are his trusted witnesses. The sissy falls, the splendid effort vain, his knowledge can't dry pebbles on the shore of the huge ocean.
Thank you. So this is a wonderful description from Sri Aurobindo of our modern humanity. Even if we believe in the presence of the divine, we're not able to see God's mighty whole. It's difficult for us to share in his vast and deep identity. He's here within our ignorant hearts, but we don't guess, we don't feel his presence, although he knows all things. Because he is one with all, he is one with each one of us. Man only sees the cosmic surfaces, the surfaces of this universe we live in. But he does wonder, he wonders what may lie hidden from our senses, and he tries to find that out by investigating in various ways. That's the work of science. A little way he delves, he digs down to depths below the surface, but he can't dig very far. Soon he stops. He can't reach the real heart, the center of life. He's not able to communicate with the throbbing heart of things, which is keeping everything alive. What he sees is just the naked body of the truth. He's often baffled. He sees all the many disguises that she puts on, but all he really can see is this naked body. He can't look deeper and understand life's soul. But if he's really determined to find out what is the core of things, he becomes furious for a knowledge absolute. He wants to know everything. Then he starts to tear things apart. He tears all details out and stabs and digs. Only the shapes, contents he holds for use. Whatever he can get out of this form or whatever it is that he's investigating, only the shapes, contents he holds for use. But the spirit escapes, or maybe even dies beneath his knife. He sees, in a sense, looking out into the universe, he sees the riches of infinity, but he has made his central field of interest and investigation the finite, the limited world. He wants to cut up that plan and discover what it is, to understand its processes. But the power which moves everything is hidden from his gaze. It's not deliberately hidden from his gaze. It's hidden from his gaze because of the way that he gazes, that he looks. His eyes, screwed up eyes, trying to see all the details, they miss all that is unseen behind those details. And yet, strangely, the human being does have some kind of way of feeling his way through the blind man's subtle, unerring touch. The way that humanity has over millennia and centuries gradually accumulated knowledge, meaningful knowledge, is a sign of this subtle, unerring touch. Or the slow traveller's sight of distant scenes. He gets glimpses here and there, but what would really help him, the soul's revealing contacts, are not his. And yet he is visited by an intuitive light. Flashes of knowledge can come to him. Inspiration comes from the unknown. Inspiration to wonderful creations. But the only thing that he really feels he can rely on are reason and the senses. Anything else he feels may be misleading. These are only reason and sense he feels as sure, as reliable. They are his only trusted witnesses. And in that way, his effort to know, to discover, is balked, blocked. All his splendid effort is in vain. His knowledge scans bright pebbles on the shore of the huge ocean of his ignorance. Here Sri Aurobindo is quoting the great scientist Isaac Newton towards the end of his life. He said, "In the end, all we have done, all the knowledge that we've found, we are like a child playing with pebbles on the shore of a vast ocean." Can you read the text? Because I don't have any numbers here.
My question is leading up to asking you how an example of seeing the naked body of truth. And according to the text, I'm getting the idea that he delves a little on the surface of things, gets a sense of something else, goes a little bit deeper, and he sees the naked body of truth, baffled by her endless guards, cannot look upon her soul. So it's like the bottom line, scanlan's bright pebbles on the shore. Is it like that? And in what would be an example of a, you get a sense of intimate.
A sense of what?
Get a sense of in meditation, for example.
Oh, yes.
Something else.
Right.
I feel like there's kind of a quite a specific experience or reference?
Well, it's this kind of thing, no? That human beings, if they're sincere, they do get visited by intuition and inspiration. But if we are staying at the mental level, then what we're seeing is just surface, the naked body. But there's truth behind it. It is possible to find the truth. But the way that we go about it with our rational minds and convinced that only reason and sense are sure prevents us. It's only a kind of blessing that may come that we get these flashes, is visited by intuitive light and inspiration comes from the unknown. But even when they come, we may doubt. We may feel, oh, what is this? Where has this come from? Can it possibly be true?
I don't think I've ever seen any kind of the truth. Glimpses, intuition. It must be like that for me.
So this is, in a way, we could say, Sri Aurobindo's, or a description from Sri Aurobindo of our modern state of mind. And yet now in the next passage, where this modern man speaks to us, Sri Aurobindo says, yet grandiose were the accents of that cry, the cry of this voice, which we're going to hear next. Cosmic pathos tremble in its tone. There's something, some greatness there in this speaker, this echo of the goddess of wisdom. So let's have a look at that. I can't see who's sitting. Yes, Tina, yes. Will you read?
I am the mind of God's great ignorant world, ascending the knowledge and steps to me, and the all-discovering thought of men. I am a God fettered by matter and sense, the animal, prisons, in a fettered form, the beast of labor, asking for his food, his smith, tied to his ankle and his fall. Yet have I loosened the cord and latched my wound. I have mapped the heavens and analyzed the stars, described their orbits to the rules of space, measured the months that separate suns, computed their longevity in time. I have delved into earth bowels, torn out the riches guarded by their dull brown soil. I've classed the changes of her stony crust, and of her biography discovered the dates, rescued the pages of all nature's plan. The tree of evolution I sketched, each branch and twig and leaf in its own place, in the embryo tracked the history of forms, and the genealogy frame of all of it. I have detected plasm and cell and gene, the protozoa trace, man's ancestors, the humble originals from whom he rose. I know how he was born and how he dies, only what end he serves I know not yet, or if there is aim at all, or any end, or push of rich, creative, purposeful joy in the wide world of celestial power.
Let's pause there. Yeah. So this is a kind of acknowledgement of the achievements of mind, the all-discovering thought of man. But this mind is a god fettered with chains on hands and feet, fettered by matter and sense. These things restrict the range of this mind, this all-discovering thought. It is like an animal prisoned in a fence of thorns. A beast of labor asking for his food. A smith, a craftsman who is tied to his anvil and his forge. The anvil and the forge are almost like his body. He can't, the tools that he has to use. But in spite of these limitations, he says, I have loosened the cord. I have enlarged my room of possibility and of knowledge. And he gives this whole list of things, and we have to say, yes, yes, you have done all that. I have mapped the heavens, analyzed the stars, described the orbits, their orbits through the grooves of space, measured the miles that separate the suns, computed their longevity in time, how long they will last, have lasted and will last. And there, coming back to the earth, I've dug down into the bowels of the earth and torn out all kinds of precious things, the riches guarded, protected by her dull brown soil. And geologists, one can nowadays see fascinating films and expositions of how the crust, the outer surface of the earth, how it has changed over so many years. No? The biography of earth, I've discovered all the dates. They can tell you what happened when. I've rescued the pages of all nature's plan. The tree of evolution I have sketched, each branch and twig and leaf in its own place. Then he says, in the embryo tract, the history of forms. This is one thing that scientists in the 18th century have seen, the similarity in the development of embryos, and deduced from that the connections between different species. I framed the genealogy, the family history of everything that lives. I've detected these things that I call plasm, the most basic form of matter, and cell, and genes. What a great discovery that was. And I've traced the protozoa, the very first living forms, were the ancestors of man, the humble originals from which we all rose. So now I know, humanity can say that we know how a human being is born and how he dies. Only, what use is he? What are we here for? What end do we serve? Why are we here? I don't know that yet. I don't even know whether there is any purpose at all, or any purpose, any push of rich, creative, purposeful joy in all these wide works of the terrestrial power, the earth power, the life goddess who's brought all this into existence. I've caught hold of all her intricate processes. None is left. Her huge machinery is in my hands. I have seized the cosmic energies for my use. I have poured on her infinitesimal, the smallest possible little pieces, and I've unmasked her invisible atoms. All matter is like a book. I've read through it, I know how to read. Only some pages now are left. This is what the scientists always say. Only some pages. We are nearly there. We've nearly got it. Who will read next? Larry?
I have read the ways of life, the paths of mind. I have studied the methods of the ant and bee, and the behavior learned of man and worm. If God is at work, his secrets I have found. But still the cause of things is left in doubt. Their truth flees from pursuit into a void. When all has been explained, nothing is known. What chose the process? Whence the power sprang? I know not, and perhaps shall never know. A mystery is this mighty nature's birth. A mystery is the elusive stream of mind. A mystery, the protean freak of blood. What I have learned, chance leaps to contradict. What I have built is seized and torn by fate. I can foresee the acts of matter's force, not the march of the destiny of man. He is driven upon paths he did not choose. He falls, trampled underneath the rolling wheel. My great philosophies are a recent guess. Mystic heavens that claim the human soul are a charlatanism of the imagining brain. All is a speculation or a dream. In the end, the world itself becomes a doubt. The infinitesimal is just mocks mass and shape. A laugh peals from the infinite's finite mass. Perhaps the world is an error of our sight, a trick repeated in each flash of sense. An unreal mind hallucinates the soil with a stress vision of false reality, or a dance of Maya veils the void unborn. Even if a greater consciousness I could reach, what profit is it then for thought to win a real which is forever ineffable, or come to its lair, the bodiless self, or me, the unknowable, the target of the soul?
shall we leave it there? There are a few difficult words, no? The elusive mystery is the elusive stream of mind. It's something that escapes from us. A mystery is the protean freak of life, life which takes so many different forms. A charlatanism of the imagining brain, something a charlatan is one of those men in a fairground who's trying to sell you snake oil and things. Falsifier. Infinitesimals jest. It's a kind of joke, the way all these quantum particles seem to work. No? So then it's as if the world is laughing at us, despite all our efforts. So perhaps this whole world is just an error of our own sight. We're seeing things wrong. A trick repeated in each flash of sense. I have heard people argue this, that actually we don't see anything continuous. We just get little flashes now and again. Discontinuous. This unreal mind of ours, it doesn't really exist. And its products are hallucinations, misleading impressions. Or perhaps all this is just a dance. Maya is the goddess of illusion, is playing out before us, our eyes. So he says, so what will be the use of me trying to seek any further? What will it bring to me? What profit is it then for thought to win understanding of a reality which is anyway forever inexpressible? What use is it for me try to find the source of the bodiless self, or make the unknowable the target of the soul? What use to make these higher spiritual efforts? Chris, would you read? Something protean is something that, well, a freak is something unusual and abnormal. And something that's protean is something that's forever changing its shape and appearance. Proteus was a Greek sea god, and he could never be grasped because he would always change his shape and escape. Yes, please.
Nay, let me work beneath my mortal bodies, not live beyond the bodies, nor think beyond the bodies. Our small minds saves us.
Thank you. So this is the conclusion that the modern mind may come to. I've got limits. Let me live within those limits. Because if we try to go beyond what is there for us, our smallness saves us from the infinite, that terrifying infinite. Don't ask me to dissolve myself, to die the great eternal death in a frozen grandeur, lone and desolate, left naked of my own humanity in the chill vast of the spirit's boundlessness. It's too much for me. Don't ask me to do this. No. Don't expect me to do that. Each creature lives by its own limits. And how can we escape our native fate? I'm human, so let me remain human until, like all human beings, I fall down and sleep in the inconscient, back into the inconscience of death. It's insane. It's a chimera. It's a mad imagination to think that the divine lives in our physical bodies, and that the eternal truth can live in human time, and that we can call to her, to truth, as if she were a goddess who could come and save ourselves and our world. How can a human being grow immortal and divine, transmuting the very stuff of which he's made? It would require a complete change of substance. This wizard gods may dream, not thinking man. Well, I think that is the response of our modern rational thought to the revelations of Sri Aurobindo. Thus wizard gods may dream, not thinking men. Is it Tina Karp there? Will you read?
When you heard the voice, the Lord answered her, and turned to her beam of light she spread. Mother of joy, mother of joy. soul draws near to God, because thou art, love grows in spite of faith, and knowledge walks unslain in the pit of it, but not by showering heaven's wall and rain upon the intellect's heart and rocky soil, can the tree of paradise flower and earth be brown, and the bird of paradise sit upon life's borders, and the winds of paradise visit mortal air. Even if thou rain down intuition's rays, the mind of man will think it earth's own being, his spirit by spiritual ego sin, or his soul breathe shut and sainthood's gray cell, but only a bright shadow of God, his hunger for the eternal, knowledge, fill his yearning heart with heaven's fire, and bring God down into his body and life. One day I will return and in mine, and thou shalt see the face, then shall the holy marriage, then shall the divine family be born, there shall be light and peace.
Mm-hmm. I love this last passage, this last short passage. So wonderful. No? First of all, Savitri, she's heard the mother of wisdom, and she's heard the warped answer which the human mind gives. So she gives her full credit. Madonna of light, mother of joy and peace, you are a portion of myself put forth to raise the spirit to its forgotten heights and wake the soul by touches of the heavens. Because thou art, the soul draws near to God. This Madonna is in all of us, and it's because she's there that we are here today and reading these words. Because thou art, love grows in spite of hate, and knowledge walks unslain in the pit of night. But not by showering heaven's golden rain upon the intellect's hard and rocky soil can you bring about the change. You can't, that way you can't make the tree of paradise flower on this earthly ground and help the bird of paradise to sit on the boughs of life and the winds of paradise visit mortal air. Because even if you pour down intuition and revelation on the mind of man, he will just think, oh yes, that's my cleverness, my human cleverness, earth's own gleam. And the result will be that his soul will sink lower because of spiritual egoism. Or he'll be satisfied with becoming a kind of saint. His soul will dream, shut up, again, so limited in sainthood's brilliant cell. The cell may be shining with light, but it's so tiny. Only a bright shadow of God can come into that limited mold of sainthood. So what must you do, you Madonna of wisdom and light? What do you have to do? You have to nurse humanity's hunger for the eternal. You must fill man's yearning heart with the fire, the aspiration of heaven, and bring God down into man's body and life. This is the instructions that she gives to Savitri. You won't be able to do it any other way. This is the way. His hunger for the eternal thou must nurse, and fill his yearning heart with heaven's fire, and bring God down into his body and life. But then she gives her promise. One day I shall return, his hands in mine, Satyavan's hand, and you, human being, you shall see the face of the absolute, and then the holy marriage will be achieved, the marriage of matter and spirit. Then shall the divine family be born, and there shall be light and peace in all the world. So the next canto is called The Finding of the Soul. We can take that up next time. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.